Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of November. World-famous oceanographer Sylvia Earle is our guest this hour. She has a new book, The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. She's been called her deepness by The New Yorker and The New York Times and a living legend by the Library of Congress, named by Time magazine as the first hero for the planet. She's an oceanographer, explorer, author, lecturer, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, leader of the Sustainable Seas Expeditions, and council chair for the Institute for the Gulf of Mexico Studies at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. She is founder and chair of the Deep Search Foundation, and she's involved in so many other organizations. She has logged more than 7,000 hours underwater, including 9 saturation dives and use of various submarines. She's received many, many national and international honors, including the National Women's Hall of Fame, the Netherlands Order of the Golden Ark, awards from Australia and other countries in the world, and we're very happy to have her with us this hour. Our phone number for you to join a conversation with Sylvia is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Sylvia Earle, thank you so much for being with us again. It's a great pleasure.
It's a great pleasure to be on board.
I love this story. Isn't it funny how some things happen to some of us when we're very young? The story of, I believe you were 3 years old, you were in the ocean, and you went headlong into a pretty big wave, and your mother's response to what happened. Tell us that story. It's great.
Well, I think she's the mother of all mothers. Instead of taking me out and telling me never to go in the ocean again, it's too dangerous, she saw the look on my face after I emerged sputtering from being knocked over by this big wave, and just smiled and let me go back in. And I've been going back in ever since.
And it started so young, your love of turtles and the things in the ocean. You were just a little girl.
Well, I think that's true of all little girls and little boys. They are curious about everything, about the world around them. Somewhere along the line, many lose it, unfortunately, or suppress it, but I think it's still there, inherent in not just little kids, but big grown-ups, too, that childlike sense of wonder and curiosity is there to be awakened. So often it gets suppressed, but it's one of the big problems, I think, that we now face with respect to our understanding of the natural world. We have lost the connection, and not all of us, and not as widespread as might be the case, but certainly the understanding that we're a part of nature, not apart from it, is a big gap in our education. We learn our numbers, we learn our letters, but we've somehow have missed out in our education system in connecting the natural world with the human world, and there shouldn't be a break. It's all one. The air we breathe, the water we drink, the planet we live upon, it's not a given. We have to take care of the systems that take care of us, and we've done a terrible job of that, especially in recent times. We've allowed so much to be destroyed without understanding its real value.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the world that your father would have been born into in, I believe, the year 1900.
That's right, yeah.
We had also done a lot to destroy a lot of the living things in the ocean at that time.
Even before the 20th century, some heavy inroads had been made in many, especially the large animals in the sea, because we noticed them and we consumed a great many whales and seals. Even in Antarctica, as soon as we made our way down there, we began to extract the wildlife on a large scale. I'm just haunted by the image of penguins being marched into great vats where they were cooked and their oil extracted.
Oh.
I mean, today it seems repugnant and not possible for us to behave like that toward penguins, but we still behave that way toward fish and even in some countries, whales and dolphins are taken for food and oil and treated as commodities, the way we treat tunas and swordfish and all the rest of life in the sea. We haven't quite accepted the fact that this, like all the creatures that we have come to understand and respect as wildlife on the land, that it's true in the ocean as well.
When was it that we decided to change our thinking, or at least started thinking seriously about the ocean and what we were dumping into it and how much we were taking out of it? I know we haven't done that to the extent that we should, even at this point in our evolution. But when did we think, maybe we're not doing the right thing?
I think we're getting there right about now. Far into the 20th century, the attitude persisted that the ocean was infinite in its capacity to yield whatever we wanted to take out and to accept whatever we wanted to put in. Putting things into the ocean as a means of disposing of them seemed like the smart thing to do once upon a time, but it has certainly come back to haunt us in a major way. Not just the mercury that makes its way back into the food chain and then back into us when we consume fish, but even more insidious than that, the carbon dioxide that goes up into the atmosphere, excess carbon dioxide not only is driving climate change, global warming, sea level rise, and other things that people are beginning to be excited about, but also acidification of the ocean. Excess carbon dioxide in the sea comes from the atmosphere. It comes from human sources. Turns to carbonic acid. That's bad news for creatures with a calcium carbonate shell, things like oysters and clams and coral reefs and many of the very small creatures that do much of the heavy lifting in terms of generating oxygen, small organisms that are photosynthetic, but they happen to have a little vulnerable calcium carbonate shell. Acidification could be an issue there. It's something that we didn't think about 10 years ago. There are many things that we're now beginning to put on the balance sheet as matters of great concern to not just the future of coral reefs and whales and phytoplankton in the sea, but our future, totally inextricably linked to what happens to the sea.
Mm-hmm. And why have we ignored it so long? Is it because we haven't explored a whole lot of it? Is it because it's so huge? You would think just instinctively we would think, this is pretty important to us. We better figure out what's going on with it and what we're doing to it.
From the surface, the ocean still looks much the same as it has for all preceding history, except in coastal areas. I went to high school in Clearwater, Florida, when Clearwater actually had clear water. It doesn't anymore. But that is just one example. All around the coastal waters of this country and around the world, Chesapeake Bay once had clear water, too. It's been a long time since you could say that about that amazing body of water. Or consider the Great Lakes that once had a very different character than they do today. There's still water there. From the surface, it looks pretty much the same. But if you go beneath the surface, it's a different planet than what it was even 50 years ago, let alone 500 years ago.
Right.
But now we're beginning to understand it and take notice and realize the consequences back to us, to our health, to our economy, to our security, but mostly to life itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it is related to knowing. We've learned more about the ocean and the waters of the world, plus all the rest of the world together, in the last half century than during all preceding history put together. It's partly because there are more of us looking around and exploring. We have new technologies to get where we couldn't go before, new ways of measuring, and very importantly, new ways of communicating what we discover. We're beginning getting to see patterns emerge about phenomena such as the El Nino phenomenon that once seemed to be focused off the coast of South America, but now is recognized to be global in its implications. We're beginning to understand what's happening in the Arctic and Antarctica with the melting of the ice and how that affects not just those individuals who are living in the high Arctic, but it has consequences that affect the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably the only organism on the planet that has the capacity to evaluate where we've come from, evaluate the past, and evaluate where we are today and anticipate the future. I mean, dolphins live a long time. They may be around for 50 or 60 years. Individuals might survive that long. They probably are aware that things have changed. They are not likely to know why, and they don't know what to do about it. Humans do know why, and we do know what to do about it. The puzzle is now, will we act on this special privilege that we have of knowing and the resulting caring, not just about other creatures that are affected by our actions, but about our own future that is totally linked to the rest of life on Earth. We could probably do, and we have done all right without this species or that, but we have torn great segments out of the living network of life that keeps us alive. Some of it inadvertently, some of it because we haven't cared. We know what we're doing, but it doesn't seem to matter. So we've lost many species in the course of losing coral reefs, and we have lost or seriously damaged on the order of half of the coral reefs in the last 50 years. In the process, we've lost countless species. They're just gone because they're associated with special areas. They don't have wide distribution. When you lose a patch of reef, you're likely to take a wedge of genetic diversity gone forever when the reef disappears. And knowing that should cause us to be alert to how we can really reverse these damaging actions, to take care of what remains of the natural world on the land and in the sea, fresh waters as well. It all ties together.
Talk about, Sylvia, the marine protected areas.
One of the big tools in our box about what can we do to make a difference is to apply the same kinds of strategies that have worked, and we need to do more on the land, as in terms of embracing special places, wild areas that have the ingredients of diversity, that protect our watersheds, that provide some sources of renewal from places that are depleted. The national parks, perhaps were not created with this in mind, but this is one of the powerful functions that national parks in this country and around the world are now playing. They're reservoirs of resilience against a changing world. If we didn't already have national parks in the bank, we should hurry up and invent them. In fact, we need to expand them. I'm in Tennessee right now attending a National Parks Commission meeting. It's a second century commission for national parks. Those on the commission, I've been in the group that represents science and conservation, but it's cultural and historic values that are also represented, deliberating about recommendations that we can make about the future of national parks for this country that might have an impact globally. Only in the 20th century has the idea that we need to consciously take care of the natural systems that keep us alive began to come into focus. Teddy Roosevelt was a champion, of course, in the early part of the 20th century. And now in the early part of the 21st century, the vision for extending that to the ocean is beginning to sharply come into focus. In the 1970s, the United States put in place legislation that made possible marine sanctuaries, in a way a counterpart of national parks, but actually more like counterpart for the national forests, because they're managed areas where fishing and other activities continue with very small areas within the matrix of national sanctuaries that have full protection for the wildlife that's there. That is, the fish and the lobsters and the clams. We need to greatly extend full protection for the creatures who live in the sea, the systems that really drive the underpinnings of our life support in this country and around the world and in the high seas beyond where nations have jurisdiction. You know, there's another whole country, another whole United States beyond the shore. Out 200 miles, the U.S. has jurisdiction over the resources that are there. And we have made some moves recently during the latter part of the recent Bush administration. Two great actions were taken to establish national monuments, not national parks, although it is partly under the Department of the Interior, but also involved with the Department of Commerce, the agency that administers the marine sanctuaries. And it includes the relative states or territories that are involved. The first one was the Northwest Hawaiian Islands that engaged the state of Hawaii, Department of Commerce, and Department of Interior as for oversight. But it was a magnificent gesture. Nearly 140,000 square miles of ocean where even the fish are safe. And the second move was in the western Pacific, the Mariana Islands and some of the adjacent places, Rose Atoll and others, that another great move to have a place that really does have some sanctity for the creatures who live there.
Sylvia Earle is our guest this hour. She has a new book, The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. She's National Geographic Explorer in Residence. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The Boston Globe has said this about her, and many people would concur. What Rachel Carson was to our planet in 1962, Sylvia Earle, scientist, explorer, oceanographer, is now to the ocean. But of course, the ocean is a part of Earth, so she is also this to Earth. We have lines open for her if you'd like to join the conversation. And the email address, we have an email coming in, which is a good one, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sylvia Earle is our guest. We have this email that's come in. Sylvia, my children and I were first introduced to you when you appeared on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Those shows opened the oceans to my children who still remember it today, years later. Thank you for your work, and I hope the president is listening.
That's really nice to hear. Fred Rogers was such a treasure.
We
did go to the Florida Keys, which is part of the National Marine Sanctuary Network, and he took off his shoes and he put on his fins. He took off his sweater and he put on his skins, and we went out into the fish's neighborhood and just had a wonderful time. Whether he was underwater, on the surface, or on the air, he was all the same person, just that wonderful friend of the world.
He sure was. I remember the day he died, we did the day after a show, and everybody, myself included, we were all crying. He had touched so many lives.
Yeah.
So many. Well, that's wonderful. It's a tribute to you, too, that her children remember to this day.
Absolutely.
Yeah, remember the ocean. We go to Wayne from De Pere next. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning.
Hi.
You got me?
We got you, Wayne.
All right. Enjoy it very much. Listen, I have a question I want to substantiate, an answer to a question. Listening to the radio the other day, I heard that out in the South Pacific, there's a large flotilla of garbage and trash floating around out there that's supposed to be about the size of Texas. I find it hard to comprehend that we've never heard anything about this. So can this gal substantiate that? Is that a truth, or is this fiction, or...
Oh, sadly, it's very much the truth, and some say it's as big as Texas, others say it's twice as big as Texas, some say it's as big as the United States. I say that it's as big as the ocean, because we have allowed what we don't want near us on the land to be deliberately or sometimes just inadvertently to flow into the sea, as if that's okay. It's a way. Well, we now understand much more completely than we did when this process began. I guess when humankind began many years ago, the ocean has always seemed like the away place to put stuff we don't want. But now we know. And yes, there is, because plastic is constitutes a major part of what we put into the ocean these days, a substance that did not exist when I was a kid. I come from the pre-plasticozoic, I suppose you could call it. And I know personally that it's possible to live without plastic. I mean, generations, for thousands of years, people prospered without plastic. I'm not saying we should get rid of plastic, but we should certainly get rid of our bad habits about what we do with plastic. And the one-time use plastics, I think, should go. We need to think about not just recycling, but different choices about how we package and bottle and otherwise take the goods from where they're generated to where they're used, and think about the total life cycle of these things. It's heartbreaking to see the remains of young birds out in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. It's a sanctuary. It's a protected area, but the adult albatrosses and other seabirds range widely for the food that they bring back to the nests, and they stuff, the whole range of bottle caps and razors and toy soldiers, the stuff that we throw away. It goes right into the baby birds, and they never get to fly. They just die because they're choked with plastic.
Mm.
And whales, there was a sperm whale that came ashore in California 2 years ago that had 400 pounds of plastic in its stomach.
Oh, my gosh.
It had taken up when it was doing its natural feeding thing, but it may have taken organisms that were trapped in the plastic, and the rest of it just trailed along. The fishing gear is probably the worst offender. Tons of discarded nets that keep on killing and killing. And there are some good news stories about this, because people are out there on beaches, and there's a great NOAA recovery plan going out to try to bring back some of this lost fishing gear. But it's a monumental task, and it starts way upstream with us, wherever on the planet we live. Just stop the flow.
Right. I was interested in a story that was on a couple of months ago. Did you see it, Sylvia, on some stimulus funds were being used off the coast, I believe, in Washington or Oregon, to get rid of some of those fishing nets, et cetera.
Right.
It was...
And responsibly dispose of them.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think we need to think seriously about our mode of fishing. Some of these destructive techniques are just doing more harm to our civilization than they are good. The idea is well-intended. Let's go get food for people. But what we're doing is cutting great swaths through what amounts to our life support system, taking creatures that are not like the animals that we raise that we can take to market in a year. Most of the fish that we consume are not only top carnivores, way beyond lions and tigers in the food chain, and thus represent a big investment of plants and sunlight energy to make a pound of tuna or swordfish or cod or any of these carnivorous fish. We don't raise carnivorous animals. We raise grazers, plant eaters, cows and chickens and pigs and things that are low on the food chain. But when you take food from the sea, take animals from the sea to use for food, you're tapping into creatures that may be 10 or 20 or 50 years old.
Oh, my.
And orange roughy are known to be more than a century old.
Oh, my goodness.
Some have been aged to be 200 years old. It doesn't make sense to have them for lunch. Why would we do this? It just doesn't calculate. It does not compute.
I remember last time I talked to you, you told me that you didn't eat fish, and it really stayed with me, because it's been touted as the alternative to meat, that we should be all eating fish.
No. Well, I think there are some alternatives, and I believe that we'll see an upswing in responsible cultivation of things such as catfish, tilapia. Chinese have been raising carp for 1,000 years, several species of carp that in ponds, they grow fast. They can be taken to market or to your table in less than a year. They eat plants. It's the efficient, cost-effective way in an ecosystem sense and in a real sense, dollars and cents sense, the use of space, the use of water, the use of the sun's energy. To eat carnivores is not only doesn't make sense economically, but it also poses the risk of accumulating through these food chain concentrations, bioaccumulation it's called. Like if you're eating a 10-year-old tuna or even a 6-year-old salmon, you may be eating the consequences of 50,000 times the accumulation of things such as mercury and fire retardants and the pesticides and herbicides and all those things that we don't want in us, but they come back to us through the food chain. When we, the higher up the food chain you go, the higher the concentrations are likely to be of things you don't want in you.
Trace the path for me, please, of how we allow all that junk and poison in the ocean. How exactly does it get there? With our consent, with our carelessness, with companies' carelessness? What is it?
A combination of all of the above, including deliberate dumping. For years, that seemed to be the smart way to get rid of New York's trash. Put it on barges, take it offshore, dump it into the sea. In Tokyo or throughout Japan, put the trash, the garbage, whatever it was, on barges, take it out to the ocean, dump it into the sea. I have not made a dive, either in shallow water or in very deep water, 2.5 miles down, anywhere in the past 30 years, without finding some evidence of the trash we have either deliberately or inadvertently allowed to go into the sea. It's cities do it. Companies do it. A great problem in Japan years ago because of mercury poisoning, and it was a great wake-up call to the world when it was realized that mercury can cause severe damage to the children when their mothers take on or eat too much contaminated fish, or mainly fish. It's a problem with creatures in the sea right now. Dolphins are seriously affected by the food that they consume because they naturally eat fish all the time. Beluga whales, similarly, they have high levels of contamination and a high level of stillborns in their, at least their first generation of offspring. But when it's carelessness in some cases, you go walking on the beach and you unwrap a piece of candy and you throw the garbage in, over your shoulder and into the sea it goes. But it's even when we try to be responsible and put garbage into garbage dumps, many of them are leaking their trash, are leaking the essence, in some cases, into the water system that ultimately flows into the sea. Groundwater is a source of much of the contamination now going into the ocean and ultimately coming back to us. What we put into the air, much of the mercury comes from coal that's burned, and the residue comes back into the sea, along with carbon dioxide that not only is driving global warming, but through the formation of carbonic acid when an excess is absorbed by the sea to set in motion another whole set of worries.
Sylvia Earle, our guest, our number is 800-486-8655. I assume that answered your question, and then some, Wayne. It was quite a disturbing answer. Julie from Rice Lake is next. Hi, Julie.
Good morning, Sylvia. Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
I have a curious type of question that I've wondered for many years, and I think you folks, I think Sylvia can answer it, and that is there friction between the ocean conservationists and native peoples who rely on the sea for their sustenance? And if there is, you know, I wonder, is that really reasonable to expect people who, you know, for generations have sustained themselves on the ocean? I'm talking about like the Inuit people, for example. And if there isn't friction, I'm curious to know why that is and how that's being addressed. But by and large, I support your work, Sylvia. But this is something I've been curious about for many years, especially like people who are vegetarians. I can understand many of their points, but for people who are, you know, indigenous peoples, who this is really their only type of livelihood, especially in a place, you know, like Alaska, Northern Alaska, where you can't grow a whole lot, I'm just curious to know your thoughts about that and to tell me what you have observed over the years with regard to that.
Sure. The big problems are not people feeding their communities and their families. The big issues are large-scale industrial fishing, where, for example, Iceland has fleets that have nets large enough in a single gulp to take in two side-by-side 747 aircraft. In the process, they engulf whole ecosystems, whole civilizations, if you will, of species that have societies, they have structure, they have age, but they take everything in mass, including many creatures that are not intended to be kept. They're simply inadvertently the cost of doing business, the bycatch. It's a huge number. We're talking large numbers of thousands of tons that are extracted from the sea every year. Did I say thousands? I mean millions of tons of creatures. When you have shrimp cocktail, think about the halo of life that has been sacrificed in order to bring shrimp to your table. The death rate is on the order of, for every pound of shrimp, maybe it's only 10 pounds. Maybe it's 100, maybe it's 1,000, but it's a big number of creatures that are swept up in the nets, that are simply cast overboard with what is desired retained. Long lines that are used to capture swordfish and sharks and tunas, also capture turtles and albatrosses and many other kinds of fish. It's bad enough to take these long-lived creatures that are taken to market and are heavily depleted. We've taken 90% of the big fish from the sea.
90%?
90. We have essentially 10% of the tunas, the swordfish, the sharks remaining from the time I was a kid, and they already had been depleted to some extent by our predecessors. But we're just using, if you wanted to start as a baseline, the middle of the 20th century, which isn't exactly a pristine scene, but from that point to the present, to deplete 90% of many of the big creatures and many of the small ones, such as menhaden, and many of the they call them bait fish, the fish that occur in large numbers, but they're absolutely vital as sustenance for all of the larger creatures in the sea, or many of the larger creatures that have no choices. We have lots of choices about what to eat. In fact, half the calories that feed the world, humans at least, come from about three plants: rice, corn, and wheat. Really are the backbone of what keeps most people alive. And then we feed these low, plants to low on the food chain animals that make up the bulk of the protein that we take up. Now, for those parts of the world where taking fish from the sea is an important part of their diet, if we weren't taking the large numbers out of the ocean using these large-scale industrial means, there'd be more to feed those who have fewer choices about what to eat. In Africa, for example, the European Union is now fished out their own waters, their own backyard, and now they're moving south and also in other parts of the world to buy the right from African nations to use these large-scale techniques to extract literally millions of tons of fish that, if they were left there, could supply sustenance from people who have fewer choices. But it's one of the problems that has just come upon us without having given much thought to the consequences. Right. It seemed like a good idea at the time, perhaps, for the European Union to go buy fishing rights when they had depleted their own stocks. But now that we see the consequences to the people of Africa, that are really their way of life is being undercut by the luxury taste for high on the food chain carnivores, the fish that cannot be readily replaced. We fish them down and then they're gone. They don't just come back in a year or two or even they've done a really good job of it.
Except that, Sylvia, it seems to me as though it doesn't take a really brilliant mind, once you've depleted your own shores, to think that you won't do the same in somebody else's shores, and those people who live next to that shore you're now going to deplete may need that resource. It doesn't take a brilliant mind. It takes a mind that cares about other human beings.
Well, it's easier to say in retrospect than it is when you're in the midst of looking around, seeing what is regarded by some of the industrial interests, that there's an untapped, relatively untapped source, and you can make a deal with a country, a willing partner, to sell off their legacy, if you will. Short-term thinking is what has caused much of the problem here. We need to really step back, all of us. We now have knowledge that none of our predecessors had, and we have opportunities that none of us who follow will have if we continue doing what we're doing. We can now hold the world in our hands and see the consequences of such actions and realize our mistakes and do better going forward. And instead of selling off fishing rights, to find a way to understand that the natural world keeps us alive. We need to be stewards of what's out there instead of thinking that it's all about us right now, to take as much as we can, as quickly as we can, make as big a profit as we can, and what? Then we die?
Right.
And then we leave the shreds to our descendants?
Right.
I mean, I am so grateful to my predecessors, our predecessors, for having the vision to establish national parks. It's a start. It's not, around the world, it's about 10% of the land. Not enough to keep the world in business. It's the unprotected, heretofore untapped part that keeps us going, and it's mostly ocean. There's some parts of the land as well that have the forests cut, and they're not in protected areas, but they are subject to exploitation. But we have a chance now, while we realize our lives depend on the natural world. To the extent we diminish the natural world, we diminish ourselves. This is not just about taking, and it's not just about those of us alive right now. It's about securing an enduring future for humankind forever, mm-hmm. for all the future of our species.
Mm. Julie, thanks for your call. Mark from Green Bay, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot for the opportunity. Ms. Earle, thanks a lot for your life's work. I got interested in the environment back in 1970 when I was working on the Great Lakes on a freighter and got into the River Rouge. It looked like you're on a different planet. That's a big Ford plant near Detroit. It was also the year that the Cuyahoga River caught fire.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
But I'm here to preach the renaissance of the Great Lakes. From that point and how devastated the environment was, to see the turnaround of the fecundity of the land now, it can show that things really can turn around. But what we've ended up with is a totally disrupted food chain. We have invasive species, we have introduced species, and yet they try to maintain and manage the resource as though we can go back to some golden age that preceded the devastation of the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Right.
So I'm thinking, why not have a Great Lakes freshwater bioreserve, bring in everything that can live in the fresh water, give them 100 years, let them duke it out, and last man standing is the best one to have in here.
Well, what you're suggesting is in some ways a part of this strategy to protect what remains of the natural systems, even though they're in some cases tattered and not all the, some parts are missing and some new things are there. But the best hope is to allow the natural systems to recover by the resilience that is what has, throughout all of the history of the world, maintained the integrity of what works. There have been catastrophic events in times past that, and somehow life goes on. The resilience of natural systems that is underpinned by having great diversity. If something doesn't work, there's somebody else there that can perhaps fill the place. If you have very depauperate systems with just a few species. If one goes, then there's a big hole that nothing else can perhaps take its place. Over the ages, there have been eras of great extinctions where more than 90% of life on Earth, of the diversity of life, appears to have become extinct, and the pieces somehow over time come back together again with a different planet, with a different assortment, and a whole lot of new things. What worries me, and I'm not alone in this, is that we humans are bringing about an era of mass extinction, losing many of the important pieces of the puzzle. There's still a chance, but every day that we continue to gobble up the natural world, we are gobbling up the opportunities to stabilize the way the world works and to secure a future for us. Eventually, life will go on with us or without us, and I urgently want there to be a place for us. Human beings are my favorite species. I have children. I have grandchildren, and I like being alive myself, and I love being a human. We're the only creature that can fly and dive deep into the sea and reflect on our past and make a plan for the future. The best hope for maintaining the natural world with anything like its present components rests with us. We're the great destroyers, but we're also the best hope.
Thank you so much for the call. Sylvia Earle is our guest this hour. Her new book, The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. She is National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and the book is published by National Geographic. Thank you so much, Mark, for your call. More in a moment at 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for Sylvia Earle, Chris from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me in Iowa and beyond the WPR. My question revolves around energy dependence and those type of things. Many in legislature encourage offshore drilling as a chance to lessen our dependence on foreign oil. Could you possibly talk about the implications with drilling offshore and the possible things going on to help stop that legislation?
Sure. The good news about this country and offshore oil and gas is that over the years, the companies involved have become far more responsible about how they go about it with a lighter impact. There is no such thing as no impact, but they're far more conscientious than in the early days when some dreadful mistakes were made. There is always a risk, but they have done a great job of trying to do what they can to minimize that. But the real problem with continuing to look at fossil fuels as a source of energy is just that they are fossil fuels. The burning of them, even the cleaner gas, contributes in ways that we would like to see minimized. We'd like to find alternatives. And the investment that we should be running flat out toward is alternatives, the sun, wind to perhaps a somewhat lesser extent, but whatever it takes. We have the brains to see our way through this tight spot that we've gotten ourselves in. Oil and gas and other fossil fuels, coal, have powered civilization to the point where we now understand what we could not have understood had we not been able to go to the moon, and that took fossil fuels, to have the connections that we now have with travel all over the world. The prosperity that humankind now enjoys is derived from our tapping into the sources of energy that have now also put us into a real bind. The carbon dioxide increase in the atmosphere and methane right along with it, these are real problems. We're finally facing up to it, and we have to not duck the issue. Instead of looking for new sources of oil and gas, we should be really turning our attention flat out to alternatives and to conserve the energy that we have. I'm so impressed by the long list that seems to be generated by people, creative people, who say, look, if we just figure out a more efficient use of the energy that we've got, we can save whether it's 20% or 25% of our consumption, and that diminishes our need to burn whatever it is that we've got. By not the destruction of the forests in the Amazon alone are said to contribute now 20% of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. If we simply halt that as one of our activities, we can go a long way toward curbing CO2 emissions. But at the same time, we have to think of alternatives about how we make better use of the energy that we've got and new sources of energy, geothermal, wind, and certainly sunlight, as the enduring way that we will keep ourselves powered through the future. It's a dead end to continue to look for fossil fuels and some of the problems caused not just by oil and gas, but by the coal extraction, the mountaintop removal in this country and around the world. The real cost of extracting these fossil fuels we're not really accounting for. If we did, we'd say, what are we thinking? Or those in the future will look back at us and say, What were you thinking?
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. We're getting close to running short on time. Here's an email that's come in. How much of the coral reef off the Florida Keys is now irreparably destroyed? I dived on the John Pennekamp Reserve off Key Largo many years ago. It was still fine. Is it destroyed today?
Around the world, about half of the coral reefs are either gone or they're in a state of great decline. In the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean and the Florida Keys, it's the level of loss is greater. It's thought to be on the order of 80%. John Pennekamp Reef in particular is one of those areas that has enjoyed protection for longer. When you stop killing the fish, amazing things happen. The reef prospers better when the whole system is there, not just the buildings, not just the corals, but the entire suite of organisms, the grouper, the snapper, the conchs, the lobsters. And it's this idea that there can be places like Pennekamp and throughout the Florida Keys, there are these special places that are truly protected, where the whole range of life is kept intact. They need to be bigger. We need to have more of them. It provides more hope. And it's one of the efforts that I'm spearheading right now, is to create networks of hope spots in the sea around the world, a continuation of what we've done on the land with national parks and other protected areas. They're protecting not just the wildlife, they're protecting us, our life as well.
We go next to John, our last caller. We're running short on time.
Hello,
hi, Catherine. John.
Thanks a lot. I wanted to ask Mrs. Searle about the organization called the Ocean Conservancy. Are they worth getting involved with donations? I received something in the mail yesterday, and I'm not sure if I should send them any money.
Yes, by all means do. I'm on their board. The Ocean Conservancy is one of the organizations, one of the few, that really has dedicated for decades attention primarily on the ocean. Of course, it all ties together, and other organizations have traditionally been primarily terrestrial in their orientation, from the Audubon Society to Nature Conservancy to World Wildlife Conservation International, Wildlife Conservation, you know, across the board, a lot of organizations are realizing that the blue part of the planet really counts, and we need to think about the entirety of what makes the planet work, land and sea together.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
I guess that came to your doorstep on just the right day, right, John? Yeah, I must have.
Didn't know what to do. Now I feel
now
good
you know
it.
What
yes,
to do.
Yes, absolutely. They'll make good use of the resources.
Right, Sylvia. Thank you so much for all you do and for the book. You're just you're a really good creature to have on Earth.
Well, thank you. I hope everyone will just think about taking a mask and slippers and jumping into some good wet part of the planet. and see the world from the inside out.
All right. We're on our way. Thank you. Sylvia Earle, our guest this hour. The new book is The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. She is a National Geographic Explorer in Residence. She has done something like 7,000 hours looking at what's in the ocean and has been called, I love this description, her deepness, and there are many meanings to that, by The New Yorker and The New York Times, and a living legend by the Library of Congress. We thank her so much for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I'll be with you again on Monday at 9 for All Things Political, which you always hear, so save up all your political comments, and we will have a great guest, as we always do, on Monday at 9. We wish Rob Schroeder well, who has produced so well for this program for the past year, found interesting guests, and has a great enthusiasm about him. He's off to the University of Chicago. So look at our website, WPR.org. Go to Kathleen Dunn to find out more about him and about his job, actually. So that's it. Thanks, everybody. Until Monday, this is the Ideas Network.